This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
What is up, my sinners? Welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, Shane Told, and I am sober for a change, which is nice. In Paris, France, we just played. And of course, as always, having an awesome time in Europe on the Rise Up Tour. We're about to hit the UK, actually. It's with Memphis Mayfire, The Devil Wears Prada, Silverstein, and Lake Moss to Flames. If you are listening to this from the UK, there are tickets available, so check it out. We're playing like 10 shows in the UK, which is a lot. Like Silverstein, we never really go to the UK for some reason. So yeah, come hang. Would love to see you all there. Today we have an awesome episode. I am so excited. A few weeks ago, we had Fat Mike from NOFX on the show, who is my absolute number one all-time favorite musician since I was a kid. He's my favorite. So that was really cool for me. But Frank Turner is probably my favorite musician kind of adulthood. And I talk a little bit about this in the show. When I heard his record, Love, Iron Song, it spoke to me in a way a record hadn't in a long time. And I actually got in touch with him, and we've been friends ever since. So it was really, really awesome. I went down to his hotel in downtown Toronto, and we had an awesome, awesome chat. Cannot wait for you guys to hear it. But before we jump in, some important stuff. Today is Cyber Monday, which wasn't a thing a few years ago, but it's a thing now. So basically, there's all this online shopping stuff going on. And one place that people like to shop online, so I've been told, well, actually, I do a little shopping myself there, is Amazon. Now, we have this thing set up with Amazon. It's called an Amazon affiliate link. Basically, anything you buy on Amazon, we get 4-6%, and it costs you absolutely nothing. So it's a really, really great way if you want to support the show, if you like what we're doing here on Lead Singer Syndrome. Please, it's really, really, really easy. Here's what you do. Go to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. That will take you right to the Amazon homepage. Log in as normal. You won't even know anything happened. But again, whatever you buy, we get 4-6%. And I know a lot of you guys are going to be doing shopping today. Christmas is coming up. Today is the day you get all the deals. So please don't forget to use that affiliate link. I'm going to give it to you one more time. leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. And if you want to get in touch, of course, email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I'm on Snapchat, which is Real Shane Told. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. And we're on Facebook, which I'm starting to do a little bit more with. So search for Lead Singer Syndrome on Facebook and you will find me. And last week, I talked about the All Access Club, which is coming really soon, which for a low monthly fee, you can get all kinds of goodies. We're going to have merch. We're going to be doing this all up. Still working out the kinks, but I'm hoping next week we can make the announcement and launch the thing. So I'm super excited about the All Access Club. It's going to be a really, really awesome way to get even more content and a bunch of cool stuff as well. Another thing going on with me is my side project, solo side project, River Oaks, which is going on tour in America, just 5 shows, New York, Philly, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Detroit. If you live in any one of those cities, please, please, please come hang out with me. I'm going to be playing a bunch of River Oaks songs. I'm going to be playing a shitload of Silverstein songs acoustic. I'm going to be doing some covers, and really it's just going to be a fun night. Tickets are cheap, like $12 or $13. So please check that out. There's VIP stuff if you're into that as well. But go to riveroaksmusic.com, and that's where you can find all the ticket links. And it's going to be a good time, so please don't miss it if you live in one of those 5 cities. Or if you live in Toronto, River Oaks and Silverstein are both playing the Stay Warm Festival with such bands as American Nightmare, Citizen, Protest the Hero, The Flatliners, A Wilhelm Scream. It's so many great bands over 2 days, December 17th and 18th. So check that out as well. All right, well, let's jump in. Here's my conversation to the always honest, the always candid, Mr. Frank Turner. It's a long road up to recover. From here, a long way back to the light.
All right, we're
rolling. Suddenly it was 2 a.m.
That happens a lot, doesn't it?
It does, and it just, like, we were in the Imperial. Do you know that place? It's a pub that's down around the corner from here.
No, I don't know. Just this like area is, this is the, like, the popular area of Toronto,
right?
Like where the tourists hang out, but people that live here don't really hang out here.
Fair enough.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we did. So JC, you know, the promoter, put together a sort of after party thing, and I went for one. And then ended up getting thrown out, kind of thing, at closing time. So, I'm a little croaky and a little sort of slow, rough around the edges today.
That's okay. I feel like that's a thing you've been doing for a while, Frank. Like, there's been a couple times I've seen you. Maybe it's a Toronto thing. You just have a good time in Toronto. But a couple times I've seen you and hung out with you here, you've been like, dude, last night.
You know, I think I have to say, I think, first of all, I think it is a Toronto thing. But also, I mean, it's worth saying that, as I'm sure you know as well, like, as your sort of, like, your disaster scale for these things gets kind of narrower as you get older. Do you know what I mean? It's like the night I had last night, if I'd had that night when I was 23, I would be whistling Dixie this morning.
Right.
Whereas now at 34, it's like, oh my God, I went to bed at 2 a.m.
Well, yeah, we're the same age. I think you're an 81.
81?
I'm an 81 too. And I started getting this thing that, which I call the 2-day hangover.
Yeah.
Which basically, you get fucked up, the next day's awful. During the rest of the night, you start feeling a little bit better, and then you don't drink that day.
And then
the next day you wake up, you feel like you did the day before.
Yeah,
in the morning.
Totally. Yeah, it's
what is that?
Well, it's us getting old and shit. and there's no escaping it for any of us. And, like, just, again, I'm sure you have this too, like, tour injuries start adding up, and, like, I've just got, like, my knee goes a bit weird some days. I have to stretch my back for an hour before we play, which is
an hour.
Yeah, it's just the most boring thing in the world. It annoys me how boring it is. But I mean, and it's like, it's not like if I didn't do it then I wouldn't be able to do the show, but it's just in terms of being able to do this in the long term and not damaging myself further, that's the routine that I have, and it's just utterly tedious.
You're a tall dude too, so that's,
yeah.
And they say that's a thing. And
yeah, I've got a winnowy sort of crappy little back.
Do you play acoustic on stage 100% of the time, or do you play electric guitar?
No, I started playing electric on this last album actually, which is a new thing for me. And it's funny, like, I always do this. I come to shit late, and that everybody else knew. I've started playing. I've got a Les Paul and the Telly that I've been playing, and I'm like, man, playing electric guitar is fucking rad.
Yeah,
and
dude.
Everyone else is like, we know that's rock music, kind of summed up. And I'm like, I never thought about this before. So now, every day in soundcheck, I sort of take 5 minutes to just kind of noodle to myself, which annoys the crap out of my sound guy and all
sure.
the rest of it. But yeah. it's playing electric guitar is fucking great.
It's the best. Just standing there and just, like, this feeling behind you, just the air pushing you.
Yeah, yeah. And then just
is unreal.
But it's a very different thing from playing acoustic guitar as well. Mm-hmm. You know, just the feel on your fingers and the kind of noise you can make. And I just, like I say, I seem to do this all the time. I mean, I sort of essentially, in a way, the history of my individual music career is that I got immersed in punk and hardcore and metal, and then one day went, holy shit, has anyone actually heard Bob Dylan? And everyone else went, yes, we've heard Bob Dylan.
Yes, we have.
Quite a long time ago. And I was like, I'd never listened to Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen or Neil Young or any of that shit until I was in my early 20s. You know, and yet I could have told you absolutely fucking everything that Propaganda ever did. Or
there,
like,
you go, I know.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, there's a part of me that sort of thinks that maybe that's dumb.
Well, I went through the same thing. You know, it's funny, with Ty, as you mentioned, we're the same age, but there was a period of my life where all I wanted to listen to was double time punk rock. If it wasn't double time, you know what I mean? If it didn't have that, nope, not for me. Like, even if it was like too slow.
Yeah.
So I was like really against anything on the radio, and especially like that shit. Like, the first show I ever went to was Bruce Springsteen.
Huh. Okay,
at the Sky Dome,
cool.
Which we maybe can see from here.
That's pretty cool.
My parents took me. I was in the fifth grade.
How old is that? I don't know what grades means.
Oh, fuck. I don't know. I was like 10.
Okay.
I hadn't heard of Metallica and started playing guitar yet. You know what I mean?
Right.
Sure. And I was just like, this guy, like, he just went on, and he just, like, the show never ended.
I
fell asleep, you know? So, but taking that forward to me, it's like,
that's the last thing I wanted to like when I was into punk rock.
Yeah, sure.
But then you get older and the same thing happened to me.
Well, you broaden out. I was going to say, by the way, this is a point of contention for me. I find it really interesting about Springsteen that I feel very strongly that you can tell that he predates punk rock as an idea. Because, of course, he's not related to punk rock really in any way. But I feel that one of the things that punk rock brought into the world of popular song was a reminder that brevity is often the soul of wit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is no one I want to see play for 4 hours. No one. There's never been any band ever who I want to see play for 4 fucking hours. Do you know what I mean? Like, piss off. I've got shit to do. You know what I mean? Like, and it's just, not least, I mean, I still go and see him because I'm a gigantic fan. But like, the last time I saw him in Paris, it was better because he actually just played more songs. The first time I saw him do a 4 hour set, he played like 20 songs. But he just jammed every single one of them out for like 8 minutes. The second song in the set was Atlantic City, and he turned it into an 8 minute long jam, and the song's 2 minutes on the record.
Yeah,
it's just
I mean, dude,
this is what the fuck, man?
Some of those guys, like Neil Young, is another one.
Oh, yeah.
He'll go on and on, and it's just like they do these big, like, you know, we talk about in the band world, I don't know if you do it too, like, we're going to have a big ending on this one, which is just like, you kind of fuck around, you let it ring, the drummer does a fill. You know what I mean? And how many times you do, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, man, after the 18th song where you've done that, I'm a little over it.
Yeah, totally. And like, the thing is, I've seen Neil Young plenty of times, and I've seen him be transcendently brilliant, and I've seen him be not. Mm-hmm. But like, I feel like I can handle 1 5-minute long one note guitar solo per show.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because he is an incredible guitarist, you know? And there is something really interesting that he does when he does that. Just kind of hanging on one note for ages. I mean, almost my favorite guitar solo of all time is the guitar solo in Words Between the Lines of Age, when he just sort of climbs up the one string and it's just aching and it's beautiful and it's wonderful. But I've seen it one time and he just did that in every song for like 3 hours. And it was like, dude, shut up. I mean, you can't say shut up to Neil Young, but like, fuck. So that's what I mean. I sort of feel like even people who weren't in punk bands and didn't really have any causal link to punk, I think that punk sort of in the late 70s kind of reminded people that sometimes less is more. You know what I mean?
I totally agree with that. But back to the Hangover. I mean, you're supporting. So that's nice.
Which
you don't
is
have
nice.
To play a Bruce Springsteen-esque
No, no,
like,
no, we
set.
Don't. Yeah, we're not doing 2 hours.
Not that you
tonight.
Do that anyways. But you're opening for the Arkells, which I think a lot of our listeners, because my podcast is like 75% Americans listen to it.
Right.
I got the stats and everything. And they probably don't know the Arkells, but in Toronto, in Canada, they are kind of a massive deal. How did you get hooked up with them?
Well, so the whole thing, I wasn't really particularly familiar with them either. And this was one of the more sort of industry-esque hookups in my life. Basically, their agent and my agent had a conversation about doing a tour swap between the States and Canada, because they're insanely vastly huge over here on the north of the border, and in the US they're not as yet. And so my agent, who I'm very close with and who I respect enormously, sort of sent me this idea and said, I think this is a good idea. So I listened to a couple of songs and I was like, okay, yeah, these guys are pretty cool, and the shows all made sense, and I sort of went, okay, yeah, I'm gonna sign off on this. But then the first show we did with them was in September, and I wanted to watch them anyway, and I tend to try and watch my supports every night anyway. And they got up and they blew my fucking mind.
Amazing.
I was just like, holy fuck. And the thing, like, there's not really any way of me saying what I'm about to say without sounding arrogant, so I'm just going to say it. But, like, it's not often that I feel genuinely threatened by a support band.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what I mean? And
like,
and I say that as a really good thing. I think it's great to feel threatened by a support band. I think you should, absolutely should. So, you know, there are some bands who won't take out bands that are going to like challenge them as support acts. Fuck you, you pussies. Take out the best fucking supports you can. And if you're not good enough to follow them, then get better at what you do. Do you know what I mean? Like, I love the idea of being blown off the stage by a support act. That's kind of how it fucking should be, almost, you know? But anyway, so they played, and I stood on the side of the stage and was like, damn, I need to fucking like up my game here. Do you know what I mean? Like, these, like, the first song, Max is in the crowd, he's got the whole crowd doing a sing along, and I was sitting there thinking, we were somewhere obscure as well, we were like in Ohio or something, and I was sitting there thinking, maybe these guys are just like big in Ohio and I didn't know, but no, they just got the whole crowd singing the first song of the set, and I was just like, holy shit, dude, that's really, really good. So I've kind of fallen hard in love with them as people and as a band since then.
That's a really cool thing. No, I always felt like you've... I mean, you're a worldwide artist, and obviously you're from England. You started there. You got big there first, mm-hmm. which is a cool thing. Like, I know you talk about it in your book a little bit.
Sure.
How, you know, you're doing, like, Wembley Arena, you know, sold out, and then you're going and doing a solo tour in Canada where you're selling your own
merch.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I love that stuff. And the Arkells, it's like the same thing. You know, they're like massive in Canada, and then they go to other countries, and no one knows who the fuck they are.
Yeah.
I always love that humbling thing. Another band I had a few weeks ago was the Amity Affliction.
Right.
Do you know this band?
I can't say I do.
They have 3 number one records in a row in Australia, and you don't even know the band.
Yeah. That's crazy.
They're a metal band. They're a metalcore
band.
Yeah,
yeah, sure.
So I love that. I love that stuff.
I think it's really good. I mean, I often think of Paul McCartney in this situation. And I mean, you know, he's Paul McCartney. There's nothing more that needs to be said about that. But, like, I sort of suspect that when he tours, it must be a little bit kind of tedious after a while. Not just because he's been doing it since the 60s, but also because everywhere he goes, it's the same. The reaction's the same. The show level's the same. The crew level's the same. Do you know what I mean? And, like,
yeah.
I find that when we do tours where we play 400 people a night in the US and then we go back and do 2,000, 3,000 people a night in the UK, I learn things from each different context that
Absolutely.
I can then translate over to the other show.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, you know, if you haven't played a small, sweaty club show in a while and then you go and play one, you kind of go, oh, fuck, okay. I hadn't thought about that for a while. I'd been getting slack on that or whatever it might be, as just in terms of you as a performer. And it's just kind of more interesting. And I just think that, like, and I say, I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this. I have no idea. But, like, Paul McCartney, it's like every show is just going to be just, I'm playing the Enorma Dome again.
Well, you know what? I mean? I read an interview with Paul McCartney one time, and somebody sort of mentioned that, like, oh, what it would be like, you know, to be you. And he's like, it's awesome. Everywhere I go, everyone's happy. Everyone sees me as just like, oh my God, it's Paul McCartney. And he's just like, hey, you know, and he's just like, you know, and I guess like
that's
if you can
cool.
handle it that way.
That's a really positive way of looking at that, actually. I like that. Oh, that makes me think of something somebody told me once, which is, apparently this is true, the Queen thinks that the world smells of fresh paint. Because everywhere she goes, they've just repainted it before she got there.
That's incredible.
The only place that doesn't is her house, is like her palace or whatever the fuck. And so, yeah, she's convinced that like sort of common people smell of fresh paint.
And that is so funny.
Which I mean, it sounds plausible.
No, but I've always respected that about you, though, that you think about the whole world. You know, you try to tour everywhere. You try to do what's best for your career everywhere.
Sure, but I mean,
you have this drive that I don't think a lot of people have. A lot of people don't give a fuck about where they're. Like, I'm from England. I care about England. I want to be big in England. Whatever the other stuff. If I'm not big there, well, fuck you. You don't understand what I'm doing.
I know what you mean. I mean, it's self-interested from my end, just in the sense of, first of all, I like traveling. I like seeing the world, and I like a challenge. You know what I mean? And like particularly the States. Canada too, but I mean, you know, it's a challenge. Like, can we get the same thing going on? And it helps in longevity in my career. I mean, I'm in a really interesting place in my career right now because I've definitely ceased to be new and interesting in the UK. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I don't get kind of like a cursory nomination at any award ceremonies anymore. Like, songs get played on the radio a bit, but like not as much as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
We do big shows, but it's kind of the same people coming to the shows, which is fine. And I love it, and that's cool. But like, it's still sort of hungrier over here. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And like, in a way, that's part of the reason why we tour over here as much, just because like I'm sort of bored of enemy journalists sneering at me in the UK. Least because I'm now reaching.
I mean, the whole UK press thing, we won't even get into that.
Well, true. But this is, okay, so this is not specific to the UK press, although it's getting that way. This is a thing. So I did my first tour in 1998, right?
Yep.
1998 was 18 years ago, right?
Yep,
and that means two things, which I love. First of all, it means I've been touring for longer than I've not been touring now, which is kind of a nice thing for me. But the second thing, and this is the great thing, is that like, and every year the bar on this raises, anybody aged 18 who starts trying to fucking tell me anything about anything, I'm like, I've been fucking touring before since before you were born, you fucking child. Like, piss off, do you know what I mean? And like, we're only 3 years away from a Vice journalist trying to tell me something about the road, and I'm going to be able to use that as a comeback, and it's going to be fucking great. I'm going to like taste that moment on my tongue. I can't wait. You know what I mean, though?
I absolutely know what you mean.
You know, there's a certain sort of like, I think that with the passage of time, like, you know, there's a trade-off. You lose the kind of new and interesting thing. Nobody can write an exciting new article about this new band they've discovered. But on the other hand, like, you accrue a certain degree of respect. And like, you know, I sort of feel like I mean, we've talked about quite a lot of old Long in the Tooth greats today already, but even we were talking about Rush before we started this.
Yes, we were.
The thing about Rush, I mean, to a degree, who gives a fuck what you or I think about Rush? They did it for a really fucking long time, extremely successfully. And
we can't understand what they went through. We can't understand the climate. You and I might be able to understand pre-GPS touring, but we can't understand pre...
Like,
fuck, I don't even know what, do you know what I mean? They didn't even have email, you know what I mean?
I did one, like, the first couple of tours I did were sort of before mobile phones and the internet, just about. There was certainly no GPS. And one of the things, a tip I got told before we went on tour, I was 16 years old, and it was so great. The tip was, if you can't find the venue, drive to the shitty end of town and ask someone who's wearing a leather jacket.
Absolutely.
Look for a dude in a leather jacket and ask. And you know what? It fucking
works. It all works every time.
Yeah, and there's some old codger like in a leather jacket, and he's like, oh yeah, I know the dog and bucket, it's over there. And but I mean, I was talking to Nigel, my drummer, who toured, he tour managed for Radiohead in the early 90s, and he was saying, touring Europe before the Euro is just like every single day you have a different currency.
What a pain in the ass.
Yeah, he was like, I had a bag with like 40 pockets on it, and each one had like a currency written on it, and like, it's a fucking nightmare. You get somebody gives you coins and change for the meal that you have on the one day that you're in that country, and you're like, oh, fucking great.
Even when we tour in like Sweden or whatever, you know, because they still have kroners, or Denmark, you know, they aren't on the Euro. I always, when my tour manager gives me... My buyout, I go, okay, how many falafels can I buy with this? Like,
right,
that's all I need to know.
Yeah,
I don't know what the money is. Just they're strange large coins, worth like $50 or something in Denmark.
But you just come home and I've got a bowl on my side at home that's just full of weird shit.
I know, it's weird ridiculous. Currencies. But back to what you're saying about your career.
Yes.
You're very self-aware of that, and I like that. I remember I emailed you, I think, on the last record, the Tape Deck Heart record, because you were getting a shitload of play here.
Yeah.
On the Edge with Recovery.
Mm. Yes.
And I guess that's sort of cool when all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, we're getting radio play for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
And things are like picking up, you know, in the mainstream. But I've never thought of you as a mainstream artist, despite in the UK you are. I mean, there's no way around it. But you know, because I found out about you, I don't remember exactly how, but I actually... People might not know this. I literally reached out to you and emailed you when I heard Love Iron Song, because that record was so special to me. And I was compelled to just to say, I have to tell this guy he's doing something that I like. And I've never done
that.
I told you in the email, the last time I did that, I emailed 88 Fingers Louie to tell them I really like their Behind Bars record.
And it's a great record.
It
is a great record.
The vocals are solo in the mix, and...
Yeah.
He can't really sing. Man, I guess that's why.
I have not listened to that record in a long time, and I think I know what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my afternoon.
Yeah, that record they put out later on, they like broke up and came back, Back on the Streets. That record's actually awesome.
Okay, I'm going to concede that you know more about Fingers Louie than I do.
But I'm just saying, you know, like that's how I, you know, got in touch with you originally, and I've followed your career obviously, and I've seen the growth, but you know. I remember it being about Frank Turner, ex-hardcore guy, Million Dead. Everyone knows the story. And seeing, you know, FTHC. And now, like, I look online and I Google FTHC or Frank Turner FTHC. And it's people asking what the fuck that means.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I just think my point is, like, that just goes to you becoming mainstream. And the average person not knowing what, like, you know... I have a tattoo of the X thing on my, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
sure.
Like, everyone knows what that is in punk rock. The
sure.
X with the, you know, New York hardcore or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And now you have to explain that to people. Now, how does that feel as a, you know, mainstream artist, punk rock artist, like, wherever you see yourself?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say in all of this is that I'm not sure it really matters particularly where I see myself anyway.
You just threw a sunglass on the bed. I think you're pissed.
No. They were just bugging my head. I wasn't wearing them, just for the record, people listening to this. They were on my head.
He wasn't wearing his Oakley shades in the...
I don't know where they came from, by the way. They were just in my pocket this morning.
I have a pair of those, and they're not that color, but they're...
It's a good color. This is great radio. I mean, it's funny. Like, I think that the position I occupy in the UK falls between many stools, and it doesn't really fit any pigeonholes, because it's like, I mean, there was a moment in time where I was arguably a mainstream artist in the UK. I'm not really sure that's true anymore. It's sort of like just a really big cult, you know, or whatever. Yeah. But it's like I'm definitely not part of the punk scene, particularly in the UK, and never really was as a solo artist. Kind of by choice, really, because I got pretty pissed off. The punk scene in the UK is extremely bitchy and backstabby, and like I just didn't want to be that guy who used to be in that band forever. So that's one of the other things I was going to say. In terms of like expanding beyond just the confines of the punk scene, I'm very happy about that. Punk rock is my high school and I love it and it will never cease to be a core part of my identity, but I don't want to just spend my life playing to just one demographic subset. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I like the idea.
Absolutely.
And in fact, we played in Ithaca, New York a couple of nights ago. And the promoter came to me after the show and he said, "That's the most diverse crowd we've ever had at any show we've ever done." And I was hugely proud of that fact because fuck yeah, I love the idea that there are sort of like older people, younger people, folk people, punk people, indie people, radio people, you know, whatever. They're like, that's cool as fuck, you know. I don't want to just play to kind of angry 18 to 25 year olds in skinny black jeans and an Against Me t-shirt. And that's me, by the way. But I want to communicate with people who aren't me. You know
hey,
what I mean?
You shit talk skinny jeans and your songs, I felt personally offended.
Dude, I've actually, this is a confession that I've not yet made publicly, and I'm going to make it now on this podcast. The jeans that I've taken to wearing on stage are on the skinny side simply Ooh. Because when I go wandering in the crowd and like, it's just makes my life easier. It, like, I kept having a thing of like ripping jeans trying to get back on the stage and this kind of shit. And so, I mean, they're not skinny jeans per se, yes. but they are skinnier than I would wear in civilian life. And every night when we play that song, I kind of die a little bit on the inside. I think that is me selling out right there.
I love that so much. But so but you don't feel a responsibility to educate your fans about punk rock.
I wouldn't say a responsibility. I mean, it's a nice opportunity, and okay. like I like the idea of. Like, you know, we took Against Me out on tour, actually, a few years ago in the UK, and it was great because most of my audience had no idea who they were. And quite a lot of my audience was slightly terrified of them, I think, because they did that thing that Against Me do of playing, like, 14 songs in a row without breaking.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly loud, and then they left the stage, and everyone in the audience sort of went, "What the fuck?" Sorry, where was I? Yeah, I mean, it's cool, like, and this is a big bugbear of mine I have about the whole gateway band thing, right?
Right.
I take my hat off to the gateway bands. For me, for our generation, I'm guessing that you're the same as me, Green Day and Offspring.
Absolutely. 100%.
Right, they were the two Green... And I'm so... I see less of it now, I guess, in my demographic. Everyone's just got over it because they've got older. But like people who sneer at the gateway bands, it's like, get the fuck over yourself. Like nobody anywhere woke up one morning and just bought a fucking Bomb the Music Industry record.
No.
That has never happened ever. I love Bomb the
Joyce
Music
Manor
Industry.
Joyce Manor wasn't the first band anyone
yeah.
heard.
Yeah, it's like you got there somehow.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? And like, you know how you got there is because you heard Dookie. You know, and like, fair enough, it's not your favorite thing anymore. Fair enough, Green Day might be doing some stuff, making records you don't like anymore or whatever the fuck, but give them the fucking respect they deserve for that. And the reason I think of that and mention that is that, like, every now and again, like, you know, somebody somewhere kind of refers to me as being like a gateway band, sometimes with a little bit of sort of condescension in it. And if all I ever amount to in life is a gateway band for people to get into cooler underground bands, I am so fucking fine with that. Do you know what I mean? If all I ever did was let the world know who Larry Nis Flask are or who Skinny Lister and Will Varley are or whatever, then I'm fucking all about that. That's great.
Yeah, but, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to when you talk about the bands, the gateway bands or whatever, which ones stick around, which ones fade away, you know, in people's minds, I think it comes down to songwriting.
Sure.
And you write great songs. I mean,
thank you.
It's a big part of why I, you know, was so attracted. I can't find the word. So
it's
attracted
okay.
to you, Frank.
It's okay. It's 2016.
No, that's, you know, well, I guess I just felt this connection was because they're great songs. And it's really that, I think. And Green Day wrote great songs. Green Day wrote better songs than The Offspring, which is why Green Day is a bigger band than The Offspring,
I think,
in my opinion.
I think you're probably right with that. I mean, I've done shows with both, and they've been and they've been fantastically lovely people. So I'm obviously biased in this, but it's interesting as well the way it cascades down, because like, remember when I toured with, do you know Fake Problems, band from Florida?
Yeah, so I
toured with Fakey Peas, and they're all about 5 years younger than me.
Uh-huh.
And for them, it's Blink-182,
right?
You know, and like, and I was a bit like, really, like, and but then I sort of caught myself on that and was like, actually, yeah, fuck it.
No, I'm Blink-182. I guess I like them.
I love Dude Ranch.
And yeah, I like Dude Ranch. I don't know. They were doing something different, and I kind of got it. But I think actually the record they put out before they broke up, the self-titled record, is probably my favorite.
I must admit, I never really gave it.
But I remember I was so pissed when Bad Religion opened for Blink 182 and just down here on the water at the amphitheater. I was like, this is bullshit, man. You know, the punk in me being like, this is like blasphemy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's funny how that stuff.
It is. Although, okay, that's an interesting thing though, because like, so on the, when we've got our first American arena show in Boston next year, and the Bouncing Souls are playing before me. Like, I saw the Bouncing Souls at the Garage in London in '98 and '99. Like, I used to, and like, I just want to get it out there that I also think it's bullshit. Do you know what I mean? It's like, they should definitely.
Are
be
you
going to
say that on stage when you play?
Absolutely. The other thing that'll be nice, it'll be clarified. You would not believe the number of people who think that my backing band is the Bouncing Souls.
Because, oh God! Yeah.
And we didn't really think about that when we were picking a name for the Sleeping Souls. But like, it's like finally the clarification will be clear.
My goodness, that's funny. Well, the other thing too is like, you know, I hit you up, you know, started. I told you how much I liked your music, and a lot of other people seem to be doing the same things. I'd like to say I was one of the first, but you know, I see like Fat Mike is talking about hanging out with his buddy Frank.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know if you're friends with you know, Bouncing Souls, but how was that being this kind of new artist, this younger guy, and having artists you look up to kind of say, hey man, I really like your stuff. Like, what did that feel like?
It's fucking incredible. It's one of the best feelings in the world. The most recent one, and this actually like nuked my world, the band that got that I learned to play guitar to was Counting Crows. And Adam Duritz wore one of my t-shirts on stage the other day.
Jeez.
And like, I've met him a couple of times, we've hung out, and he's a super lovely guy. But like, he wore one of my fucking t-shirts with my fucking name on it on stage at a show. And I was just like, cool, I retire. You know what I mean? It was like, but I think the thing about it is like,
it's also crazy when it's your name too.
Yeah,
like, 'cause you know, I always wanted to ask you about that is like, you come from punk rock, you come from hardcore, you know, and a lot of the solo guys, like I have a solo project that I started, but it's not called Shane Told, it's called River Oaks. And I chose a name almost specifically because it felt weird to use my own name.
Sure.
What was the choice you went? You probably answered that question a million times.
I think the thing for me was it was quite reductionist. You know, like when I, because the whole thing for me was like, having grown up with a lot of like angry heavy music, and then I got really into sort of like the sort of crazy core thing, you know, like Dillinger, Converge, Botch, Cave-In, all that kind of stuff, like super complicated woodley metal stuff. And then like Jesus Lizard were like a huge deal for me they still are, but like, and in Million Dead, like we'd write a riff and then try and think of ways of making it weirder. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, and like complicating the issue on purpose. And that's fine as far as it went. But the whole point about playing solo shows for me was I was trying to put myself out of my comfort zone, because I think that's a really important thing to do as an artist at all times. But also, and within that, to be reductionist, it was like, rather than kind of screaming obscure, and frankly, I can say this with the benefit of hindsight, deeply pretentious lyrics about Polish communism in the 1950s over like a weird beat and a noisy, angular, odd guitar riff.
Sure.
It was like, I'm going to play G, C, and D. I'm going to tell a story. And right. I'm going to do it under my name, and I'm going to be just me, and I'm going to use standard tuning on the guitar, and I'm just going to fucking see what happens. And I mean, obviously, you know, I've sort of departed from that to a degree over time in my solo career, and should have done. But that was, you know, that was kind of the point, was it was kind of like year zero. Do you know what I mean? It was like, no fucking around.
But I mean, you've grown too. I mean, now, you know, we talk about the Sleeping Souls. That's something you've involved more and more, even with writing. Right?
A little bit here and there. I mean, mainly arrangement stuff, actually.
Yeah.
So I tend to kind of write a skeleton of a song, like a verse, a whole song, but like just kind of guitar chords and vocal melody.
When did that sort of start for you, that you were like, okay, you know, I've done all these shows by myself, and then I've added some other instrumentation. When did it kind of become, okay, I don't want to just be Frank Turner. I need to be the and somethings. Yeah. And like, why was that important to you?
Well, it struck me that there are sort of two models of the backing band. there's the sort of Ryan Adams thing, although he's actually changed this, but you know,
for right, a long time, the Cardinals
just,
and
yeah, he's, but sort of before the Cardinals, it was just Ryan Adams and some other dudes. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean? And if you were a ticket buyer, you wouldn't really know who they were, and they wouldn't necessarily play on the records, and that's fine. And that's what, there's nothing wrong with doing it that way. But the other model is the E Street Band, you know, where it's like you know who the people in the band are, and it's the yeah. same people every time. And I always thought that was. That was a better model to my mind, and a kind of more musically more interesting model. And then we just kind of, once Matt joined the band, because he was the last guy to join in 2008, once Matt was in the band, it just sort of started coming together. Like, and we just, there's a certain, and I'm sure you know, there's a tightness that you get with playing people over time that yeah. cannot be shortcutted.
Yeah.
You know, so that happened. And then, I mean, the real baptism of fire was we did a tour. I'd done quite a lot of American touring just solo.
Yeah,
because financially that's sort of how it worked out. But we did this tour in the start of 2010, opening for Flogging Molly over here. And we were in an Econoline. We had one crew member. I was doing merch. We were driving. It was super long drives. We had fucking no money, like losing money, like hand over fist. And like, and that tour was like the baptism of fire. Once we got through that, it was like, we can handle anything from this point. Do you know what I mean? And like, there were full-on bust-ups. There were people kicking hotel room doors in, you know, quitting the band, rejoining the band, and just like,
damn,
it was extremely fucking hard. And I mean, and I think that it would have been hard for any band in any situation, but it was also our first American visit, and we came out the other end of it kind of slightly dazed and battered. But it was a bit like, after that, yeah, fuck, man, you know, we can take whatever the world is going to throw.
It's also, you know, probably hard being just you for so long. You make every decision. Like, I don't know. I mean, there's probably times when it's like, okay, well, played a great soul that show. Going to go back to my hotel room by myself now. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, is there a part of the element of just sort of having someone to share it with too?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like the whole point about being in a band is that you're a gang. You're
right.
you're a pirate ship.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you sail into town and you know, ravage and pillage and then sail out again. And you know, you've got buddies. I mean, there was definitely a point where I had tour stories that I could only really tell myself. You know what I mean? But I've been comfortable. I'm comfortable in my own company. I'd say that. And it's funny, like, the relationship I have with the Sleeping Souls is a finely balanced one over a long period of time, mm-hmm. because we're not a regular band. We haven't morphed into a regular band. It's still my show, you yeah. know, and I still call the shots. But they're also not just hired hands, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They are an integral part of it. And it's an arcane and delicate thing that would take a long time to explain.
No, I get it. But that's interesting, because for me, I've only ever been in bands where obviously there's a couple guys in charge. You know
sure.
what I mean? Every band is like that. There's no band where it's... there's very few bands that are a true democracy.
Yeah, well, interesting that you say that, because actually Million Dead kind of was attempted to be that. And
yeah.
I think that it was a blessing and a curse. I think it made us a much more interesting band musically than we would otherwise have been, because everybody challenged everybody on everything all the fucking time. It's also the reason that we broke up. It's because we all wanted to fucking murder each other
right.
After not very long period of time being a band. But I'm glad I did it at that point in my life. It was fucking great being in a room, coming in with a riff that you think is the best thing you've ever done in your fucking life. And the drummer goes, switch the last two notes around. And you're like, you're a fucking drummer. Do you know what I mean? But then you do it anyway after, because we were so committed to this idea of democracy.
Yeah.
You do it anyway. And then you kind of go, oh, yeah, okay. Fuck you. But yeah, you know, but it, like I say, it killed us as well. So I know what you mean. I think most bands have a
no,
boss.
Totally. I want to ask you about, I was actually ran into a couple guys from As It Is. They're a UK band, pop punk band. And a guy told me I was going to talk to you, and he's like, oh my God, I love Frank. And he was at your 1,000th show, I guess?
Yes.
You played in a car park?
I did, yes,
and
Shoreditch.
He said, it was just you, right?
Yeah.
And he said it was the coolest thing that you play an acoustic and they broke the barricade.
Yeah, they did. That's very cool.
And, you know, you just think of a guy with an acoustic guitar
yeah.
and like, that is some... That's
yeah.
something, man.
I mean, I have to say it was partly because the show was pretty shambolically organized and it wasn't like a real barricade particularly. But I mean, it's funny, like you do get, like I did a solo show in London as a benefit for the Music Venue Trust, who are trying to protect small venues in the UK, in the summer sometime. I can't remember. Life
yeah.
is slipping away. And it's like the people like crowd surfing during like the finger picking songs. And I am a little bit like, dude, what are you doing?
Like, I know.
But I mean, it's nice to provoke a reaction, I suppose.
Absolutely.
That show was funny. Like, I mean, I feel like I can tell this story now because those days are in my past. I'm very pleased to say, I used to get very fucked up in my younger days, and my payment for that show was chemical, shall we say?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like it was a benefit show.
Yes.
And my payment for the show came in a little packet, and it was in the dressing room. But the thing that was so fucked, right? In fact, hold on, this whole story is worth telling. So I had the most idiotic bit of tour routing. I had like a promo trip to Germany. And this was all right before England Keep My Bones came out as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Had a promo trip to Germany for like 4 days. Then I flew to Australia for a week. Then I flew back from Australia to the UK via Germany because that's how the flights worked out, which was a fucking nightmare. Got back to the UK. I had one day off. Then I did my 1,000th show. Then my mother got remarried the following day.
Oh, my
God.
And
I was not in the best of headspaces because of the night before. I was giving my mom away. And the other thing is I just got my first finger tattoos, and my mom hates tattoos, and it really wasn't the day to have that discussion with my mom.
Yes.
So I spent the whole day with my thumb over my little finger because I didn't want her to see it. But anyway, it was fantastic, and my mom got remarried, and it was a wonderful thing. And then the following day, I flew to Toronto. And by the time I got to Toronto, that is the most jet lagged I've ever been. I just had no idea what year it was. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I remember, and I think I was somewhere around here, and I was just kind of walking up and down the street at like 4 a.m. just being like, what? what's happening right now?
I know.
So, and then I did my 1,000th and first show in Toronto, and that's the one I got the tattoo for because I thought it would be cool to kind of commemorate going forward rather than backwards.
What does it say?
Oh, it's just 1001.
Oh.
I just got that one done, stick and poke in a hotel room.
Sick. No, yeah, yeah.
But it was
great.
You know, not thousands of first, man.
No, I'll never forget the time we got to Australia, and I got off the plane, and I was like, couldn't get check in the hotel yet because it was too early in the morning, and I went to try to order a beer, and the woman goes, excuse me? I go, yeah, whatever, the IPA. It's 7:45 in the morning. I'm like, oh, and I'm like, you know, you don't know.
Yeah, sure.
You don't
know
what time. Like, it's funny how that shit, shit happens, well, man, so when you get so jet lagged.
The first time I ever went to Australia, I flew from LA with Chuck Reagan and Ben Nichols and Tim Barry, Ben from Lucero. And we got to the hotel, similar deal. We got to I think we had started in Perth. And we got to Perth and checked into this hotel, and it was like 10 a.m. And Ben, do you know Ben Nichols? Do you know him personally?
No, I don't know him personally.
Okay, he is one of my favorite people in the world. And he was just like, all right, I want a whiskey. And he's straight to the bar. And I was like, dude, I get it. I'm jet lagged too, but don't have a whiskey at 10 a.m. on your acclimatization day. That's idiotic. You're just going to lose your mind. But he successfully just drank for 12 straight hours and went to bed. So
that's pretty much how I roll when I get to Australia, whatever.
Isn't it the greatest, Australia?
It's the greatest. I was just there a couple months ago.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I haven't been in a year.
Yeah.
Fucking love Australia.
Do you do well in Australia?
Yeah, we do pretty good. It's sort of been picking up over time. Like last time we were over, we were doing 1,500 people a show kind of vibe.
Beautiful.
So.
Beautiful.
That was lovely.
So we talked about 1,000th show, 1,001 show. You got number 2,000 coming up, don't you?
Yes.
Do you know when it is?
Yes, I do. And I'm now in a kind of weird position of not being able to do any extra shows because the count is set. Do you know what I mean? And it's
like an impromptu show on the steps of the hotel. It'll fuck up the count.
But I mean, the thing is, it's in some ways it's kind of liberating because I can just say no to all to things I get offered. But it's like when we were in August, we were in Minneapolis with Foggy Molly, and there was it was an outdoor show, and there was this rainstorm, and we played, but Foggy Molly got rained off, and some friends of mine run the Triple Rock in Minneapolis, and they were like, dude, just grab a guitar and come over and play a set. We've got a bunch of wet
fuck
people
yeah.
in here. And I was like,
rock.
I can't do that because I'm on account for show 2000.
No, then you just make it 1965.5.
Nah, you see, that's cheating, man. That's
it's
cheating.
Totally cheating.
It's cheating. But
it's
so,
totally
so
cheating.
There's a venue in the UK called Nottingham Rock City. I don't know if
I know
you're familiar.
Yeah, I know very well.
I adore that place. I've been playing there since 2002, I'd guess, with Million Dead. And
I like that old guy that cooks all the food in the basement.
This is a story I was going to tell, right? Okay. This is going somewhere relevant. What we were talking about earlier about surviving in this industry and going on for a long time, that kind of thing. One of the things that I've learned and one of the things I'm proudest of is bands come and go. Do you know what I mean? The people who are in this for the long haul are the crew. Do you know what I mean? And venue staff, all that kind of stuff. And there's so many people who are in bands for a couple of years and tour for a couple of years in their early 20s, and then they go off and do something else in their life. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's totally fine. But it's just I mean, for example, my production manager, Dougie, like before he came full time with us, he was the guy who would do a band for 2 years who had one album that was big in the enemy who would then disappear.
Yeah.
And he did that over and over and over again with some band who were briefly popular. And anyway, so so with Rock City, they had the chef in the basement, right?
Yes.
As you know, it's like the Hell's Angels or that crew.
I actually didn't know that. No.
Yeah, that's the vibe with the people who run it.
Okay.
They in the basement they have this chef, and the deal is if you play the big room there, then they cook food for you. But if you play the like 200 crap room, it doesn't work out financially.
Okay.
For that to be a thing, and I was touring summer 2014. I was touring with Mongol Horde, my sort of noise rock side project.
Yes.
And we were playing the small room, and therefore I was not expecting catering. And I got in there, and the chef was setting up, and I was like, "The fuck, dude!" Like, I think I was like, "Who's playing upstairs?"
Right.
And he looked at me and he said, "Fuck you." He said, "You're one of ours." He said, "You really think we're not going to fucking cook for you of all fucking people? Shut up and eat my fucking food." And like, which is his way of being affectionate. But I mean, I'm sort of slightly blowing smoke up my own ass. Forgive me for that. But like, that feeling that the lifers in this industry accept me as kind of on their terms is a really, really important thing to me, and it's the thing I'm proudest of.
It brings a little tear to my eye. You know what I mean? Because like, it's a family out there.
It is,
you know.
And, like,
and treating people with respect at venues and making a good reputation for yourself is fucking important.
Oh my god! I was having this conversation with somebody the other day who shall remain nameless, who's in a band. I was like, you do understand that your crew are your ambassadors. If your crew walk into a venue and they're dicks
right.
to the people in the venue, nobody goes away going, "That guy's crew are dickheads." They go away saying, "That guy's a dickhead."
Exactly.
And it's on you. Like, you need to pay mind to that shit. And that's aside from the fact that manners matter anyway. Do you know what I mean? And you should be decent to people because you just fucking
should. Of course,
shouldn't.
Right.
But I mean, so one of the other ones, Reading Festival, they have the same crew every year, and I've just done my 10th year at Reading.
I read that, yeah.
And the thing is, I am the last person who would ever do that thing of not having a pass and having like a photo put up around the place, because fuck bands who do that. But like, but I basically don't need a pass at Reading
because
it's cool. But so all the security stuff there know who I am now,
yeah.
And I do not need my backstage pass anymore.
Oh, I see. Like, to bring me the
thing is, but the thing is, I always carry it and always go, "Here's my pass," and they're like, "For fuck's sake, like, it's fine. Like, we know who you are." And I'm like, "No, I know, but I just don't want to be that fucking guy." Who was it who did the takedown of Bring Me the Horizon on that? It was like,
Bad Religion.
Yeah, Bad Religion.
Brian Baker.
Yeah, Brian Baker. That made my year. It made me so happy, that whole exchange. It was just because Brian's a funny motherfucker, and like
I've heard people, I won't name names, but I've heard people say, "My face is my pass." I've heard people say that to me, and I'm like, come on, dude.
The thing about it is it just lacks consideration. You know what? The person working at the venue didn't buy a ticket. They don't know who you are, and they don't give a fuck. Do you know what I mean? Maybe all of the fans do. That's legit. But the guy who's working the door, who's done 6 shows this week already, doesn't give a fuck about who you are, and he doesn't have to give a fuck about who you are because he's doing his fucking job, and his job is to check fucking passes, and is it really the end of the fucking world to put a fucking pass on? Anyway,
I feel the same way. So wait, where's your 2000 show again?
So Rock City, yes.
It's at Rock City, okay.
It's at Rock City, which is going to be great. And like, that was the thing. So when we were choosing where to show 2000, like, essentially the reasoning went, initially I was thinking about doing it in London, and then I've got a big announcement coming about London for next year, which I can't announce just yet.
Okay.
Actually, when's this going to go out?
Probably in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, I'll hold off. There's a big London announcement coming in.
Okay.
We were like, okay, let's not do it in London for that reason. And then it was like, I grew up in Winchester. I don't live there anymore. And there isn't really anywhere in Winchester that's bigger than like 600 people. And that seemed like it would piss a lot of people off if I did it that way.
Right.
So then it was like, okay, what's my favorite venue outside of London? And it's Rock City.
There you go.
And there
that's
it is.
Awesome.
In fact, well, Rock City is my favorite venue full stop in the world. But aside from Rock City, I don't really have any ties to Nottingham as a city. But
that's
a great
awesome.
Place. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. We just did our, Silverstein, we just did our 2000 show.
Oh, fucking, oh shit, you motherfucker.
We beat you.
Damn it.
We're ahead. But
congratulations.
I feel like you've been catching up. So, no, we did our 2000 and we didn't, well, we just kind of do it. We aren't going to plan it. So our 2000 show was in Kyoto, Japan, opening for a Japanese band in like a 350 cap room.
Wow.
Like, it was super,
yeah.
Like, and I, you know, I got up there. No one knew, gave a fuck who we were. Just, we were just, you know, opening act. Everybody's Japanese.
I've never been to Japan. It's really bugging me.
Hold on. Well, let's get to that.
Okay.
That's wild. But I think at one point I stopped and I said, by the way, Japanese people that can't understand me,
yeah.
today is our 2000th show, so go us.
Yeah totally.
Kind of looked at the guys on stage and went, all right, I guess we'll play another song now. So yeah. It wasn't a big celebration.
Sure. When's that since? When was show one?
Show one would have been in 2000.
Okay. So yeah. You've got a run up on me there.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. We got a run.
That makes me feel better.
Oh yeah. No, you've packed it in, man.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's a funny, but it's okay. The thing about that, something I've realized as I get older, there was definitely a moment when I was in a bravado competition with myself about my tour schedule.
Right.
And it was a major moment in my life where I just kind of went, and it was when my back went out because I slipped two discs in my back, and it was kind of horrendous. And it was just a bit kind of like, I want to do this for the rest of my life if it's at all possible. And that's not down to me entirely, but it is to a degree. And like, you know, it's just like, what is the point in me like murdering myself in my early 30s if I then, you know, and it's just like nobody else is competing with you on this. No one else gives a fuck.
No.
Do you know what I mean? And like, and suddenly it was just like, maybe I could have a few more days off and maybe have a week off between tours and, you know, do that kind of shit. And I mean, I have a now, as of a year, I have a long-term girlfriend who reminds me to take holidays and that kind of shit. And it's great. It's great. It makes me feel like a grown-up.
It's just, I guess you just get used to doing it a certain way, pushing yourself until you feel like if you're not pushing yourself, you're not working hard enough or something, you know? And your own worst critic, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, I have huge respect for Henry Rollins. I finally met him a couple of days ago, and that was a huge deal for me. But I mean, and I say this with as much deference as I can muster, but like there is a degree to which like Rollins is more of a sort of pastiche of a human than a person at this point. Do you know what I mean? Because he is this dude who he has this sort of thing to live up to. Do you know what I mean? And like I saw the show, he walked on stage, this is my 100th show in 19 different countries on this tour and blah, blah, blah kind of thing. And part of me wanted to be just like, dude, have a beer.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And that's not Rollins.
He's an intense man.
He is an intense man, and that's who he is and all the rest of it. But like, similarly, like, there's somebody famous who I know who's going to remain nameless because it's not right for me to name names in this situation. But like, a friend of mine commented about him, a mutual friend commented about him, he speaks like he's giving an interview all the time because he's just been doing it for too long. And it was like, you kind of ask him, how you doing? And he kind of goes, well, I'm glad you asked me that. And it's just kind of like, that's not how human beings interact.
That's kind of common in our world, though.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But
you know when you meet a guy in another band and you're talking to him and you're like, dude, I'm not interviewing you, man.
Yeah,
like, we're just dudes.
Yeah, totally.
Which is part of why I like what this podcast is about.
Sure.
It's just people chatting and not worrying about, you know, the fucking structure of an interview or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's, you know,
so the
that's
tour's
a whole
going
other
quite
story.
Well. And
yes, I'm glad. No. yes, tour trade.
I once considered getting a t-shirt printed with "the tour is going quite well, thank you" written on it and just sitting down for interviews and like unzipping my jacket.
Could you state your name and what you do in the band for the record, please?
Yeah, well, I mean,
that's my favorite.
What's your most asked interview question?
Probably, how's the tour going?
Yeah.
Probably. But that's like not even a question. That's just like a you sit down
sure.
It's kind of just like, oh, how, you know,
right,
how's life?
So my most asked question is like, what was it like going from being in a punk band to being a solo act? Right. And and it's like, it's a fair question.
Yes.
But I have also discussed it in every single interview I've done in the last 11 years. And like, you'd think you could just look up the answers to that question now.
Right.
You
there's ways
I mean?
Of navigating. There's a way of getting a specific response.
Sure.
To which I guess maybe people just aren't that savvy with.
Sure.
You know, and it ends up just being super generic. But I know we're getting to be about that time. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. There's so many other things I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you about Trump. I wanted to ask you about Brexit.
Yeah.
I know you're a political guy, and it's that time of year.
Well, as we record this, we are 3 days away from the apocalypse, potentially.
Potentially, yes.
Potentially. I mean, I'm a kind of, to many people's chagrin, I'm something of a kind of like wacky libertarian in my politics. I mean, that's what people call me. I prefer to think of myself as just a liberal who knows what that word actually means. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I consider myself an extremist liberal. but like, so with all that, I'm not a huge fan of the Clintons and the Clinton Project per se, but like, it is baffling to me that anybody could vote for Donald Trump. And I say that with quite a well-versed understanding of people's problem with the Clintons. Do you know what I mean? I'm not like some ingenue who doesn't understand why people hate the Clintons. I do understand. I've been following American politics all my adult life, and I get it. But the man is just... I don't know what to say. He's just a piece of shit. He is a gigantic piece of shit. And he doesn't stand for anything. For like almost the first time in my adult life, I am fucking baffled. Like,
yeah, I mean, the fact that he even got nominated is embarrassing.
Yeah, I just,
I mean, we're not Americans.
No, sure.
So people will say, well, we don't have a fucking right to say, but
well,
we do.
We do. We have a right to comment because it's the world superpower. But like, I'm a huge fan of America and the American project. I think that America, and this is almost the thing that saddens me most about Donald Trump, is I think that up till today. And indeed for another 2 days, regardless of everything that's happened, and even just in my sort of politically aware lifetime, the Iraq War or whatever, America is still the shining city on the hill. It still is, in terms of setting a standard by which of a political system by which the rest of the world can aspire to. And actually, one of my pet peeves in life, and I feel this, and I felt this a little bit about Rollins the other day and about a lot of stand-up comedians, is Americans who don't realize how fortunate they are to be Americans. They sit there going, yeah, everything's totally fucked. And I just want to grab them and be like, try living in fucking Hungary, you dickhead. Or Russia. Or Venezuela. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, yes, there are
Hungary's
problems.
Hungary's pretty sick, come on.
Hungary's pretty
Budapest,
sick, but I mean,
fun city.
Fun city. Totally fucked politically right now. They've basically elected a fascist government. Bad news. But this is the point. I mean, of course there are problems with the American political system. But the simple fact that the entire world is hinging on the outcome of a popular vote right now is a good thing. That's a wonderful thing. And we should take a moment to just appreciate that. And I just can't fucking stand Americans just sort of wandering around kind of going, yeah, man, we live in a police state. No, you fucking don't. You want to know what a police state looks like? I can fucking show you. They exist. You don't live in a fucking police state. You live in an imperfect world, okay? And within that, yes, complain, make things better, fight injustice, you know, campaign to make the world a better place. But at least take a fucking moment to just look around and realize that of all of the places in the world you could live, America's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Anyway,
you were gonna quote propaganda for a minute there.
Yeah. but having said all that, I mean, like, so, I mean, that's the thing about Trump is, to me, he represents the possibility of the sort of end of America's sort of like beacon status. Do you know what I mean? And in a way, almost, I'm worried that he's already done that simply by coming within one person.
Just even getting there.
Yeah, getting where he is now. And that really saddens me because I think that on balance, America is a force for good in the world. And I say that as an outspoken opponent of the Iraq War. But the fact remains, I think that on balance in the second half of the 20th century, America did more good than harm in the world. And I worry for a world that doesn't have that kind of moral example leading it.
Totally agree with you, man.
You know, so there we go. That's what I think about Donald Trump.
There you go.
Fuck
Thank
that
you very
tiny-handed
much.
Tiny-handed little shithead. Well, PJ O'Rourke, who is a writer I don't necessarily always agree with, but who I always read, said a wonderful thing. He said, Hillary Clinton can be anything up to and including the second worst thing that could happen to America, and I will still vote for her. And I think that is a fucking salutary statement.
Yeah, I agree with you. And him.
And
or
yes.
her.
Him.
Her.
Him.
Him. Just making
he's
sure.
He's great. He's
There's
he's,
nothing worse than having a name and assuming it's a man.
Oh, yeah.
If that's ever happened to you, your tour manager.
My tour manager, yes.
I was told, I got an email, though, and it specifically said her in there.
Yeah.
Because I would have assumed Trey.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. It's actually Tree.
Tree.
Everybody in this country says Trey.
T-R-E.
She's kind of given up on that one now. Like, everyone just calls her Trey over there.
Right, but that's the kind of thing. Like, if you're a fucking asshole, piece of shit, but... I've been guilty of it.
Me too. But what I love about Tree, Tree is my tour manager. She is the best tour manager in the world. And it's not just me saying that. She actually won Tour Manager of the Year award a couple of years ago.
I didn't know there was an award for that.
There was a live music award in the UK and she won Tour Manager of the Year. But anyway, she actually uses that to her advantage in a way that I really enjoy.
Oh.
Because if you've got one of those like sort of slightly old school, slightly dickhead venue owners or whatever, or venue managers, who then kind of goes, oh my God, Tree, you're a woman, and sort of starts like huffing and puffing a little bit. And she kind of like uses it to like plant a flag in their territory and is like, yeah, dickhead, and this is how today's gonna be. and it's kind of a neat little trick.
Oh man, that's funny. Well, dude, hey, I won't take up any more of your time. You got a show tonight.
It's been a wonderful time.
It's
we should do this again.
There's so much more to talk about.
Well, exactly.
We'll do a part two whenever you're ready. Let me know.
Okay, well, in February we are playing in Hamilton with the Arkells.
I'm home. We're doing a record. So
come down.
Hamilton's not too far.
Again, great radio. We're gonna shake on this on air.
Absolutely. Let's do it on air. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So there it is with Frank. Always great to see him. What a guy. Always speaks his mind. I really have so much respect for him. It was really cool for him to take the time out of his busy schedule and sit down with me. Thank you, Frank. And there was a lot we didn't get to, but we did shake hands for real. He will be on. We will do a part two, and we'll get to all the other stuff we didn't get to in this episode.
Next week, we will be back on Monday. As always, I do not take weeks off. Well, once in a while. But I will not be taking the week off next week. So make sure you're subscribed. However you listen to your podcast, there should be a little subscribe button. If you're listening on your computer or on your phone and you're using like a web browser, no. Get a proper podcast app. It will save you so much hassle. In fact, the iPhone one is already built in. Some people don't know they have it, but I don't even think you can delete it. So it's there. So please go on, search for Lead Singer Syndrome, subscribe. And if you like the show, also tell a friend. Try to spread the word. Let's keep this thing growing and let's make this thing even bigger and even better. As always, I'm going to leave you with a tune from the guest. I'm going to play you the first Frank Turner song I ever heard, the first song from Love Iron Song. It's called I Knew Proof Rock Before He Was Famous. Here it is on Lead Singer Syndrome. We'll see you next week. Peace and love.
Let's begin in the beginning. We're lovers and we're losers. We're heroes and we're pioneers. We're beggars and we're choosers. Skirting around the edges of the ideal demographic. We're almost on the guest list, but we're always stuck in traffic. We've watched our close associates up and play their parts, chatting up the it girls, and they're tearing up the charts. While we were paying with coppers to get our rounds in at the bar, with a C team, with the almost famous old friends of the stars. Is the last great romantic poet. He's the only one among us who is ever gonna make it. We planned a revolution from a cheap Southampton bistro. I don't remember details, but there were English boys with banjos. Jay is our St. George and he's standing on a wooden chair. And he sings songs and he slays dragons and he's losing all his hair. And Adam is the resurrected spirit of Graham Parsons, in plaid instead of rhinestone, and living in South London. And no one's really clear about Tommy's job description, but it's pretty clear he's vital to the whole damn operation. And Dave Danger smiles at strangers, treats the safest girl I know. And Zoe and Hobbs will scamper up to victory in the city we call. We won't change our ways. We will proud remain when the